Godspeed with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbeck. David Pacchio is the author of the award-winning blog, My Caravan of Dreams. In it, he documents his thoughts and reflections while treading the Sufi path. Among other topics, he writes about his experiences as a Roman Catholic entering the mystical practice of Sufism and encountering Islam in its many forms, especially in the backdrop of being a New Yorker who lived through 9/11. Dave, welcome to the Institute, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Carol. It's really a pleasure to be on, and always really enjoyed your type of programming you put out, so just happy to share my experiences with all of you.
Oh, terrific, and thank you, because I'm sure this is going to be a very meaningful exchange as well. Yours is a fascinating journey, one that explores an age-old mystical path, but expressed in the most current medium of blogging on the web. Your blog was noted as a top Muslim blog in 2010, and yet your roots appear to be Roman Catholic. So that's a fascinating foundation to begin. And why don't you tell us, if you can, where does your spiritual story begin? And please, take your time. You have the floor.
All right. When I think about it, my spiritual story starts, I think, with my grandfather, actually, who was someone who just, you know, used to spend a lot of time in contemplation while he was working, and he asked a lot of deep questions, you know, that carried over to my father, who did the same thing. And when I was born, as early as I can remember, they always encouraged me to think deeply and then never be satisfied with just the basic answers that I would get. So, for instance, you know, my father, from a young age, introduced me to ideas about readings on yoga, on Tibetan Buddhism, on many other, I guess, spiritual traditions. And I think that was the environment that I needed, and, you know, to start asking questions. And then from there, you know, this longing, this search for answers, you know, just took a primary place in my life. And that's really where everything begins, if you can put a point to it.
Now, did your family have a particular faith tradition, or how would you describe how is the perhaps sacred experienced in the family?
Okay. Well, my family's from Haiti, and we're all very, very religious. You know, they grew up in the world of Roman Catholicism. And I think even for a while, my uncle was in a seminary to become a priest and such like that. So we were deeply rooted in the Catholic experience, and I feel like the images and the symbol of Christianity of you know, the hard work and the sacrifice for others was deeply ingrained in all of our experience. Even here, you know, when my parents, They used to tell me when I was younger that they made the sacrifice to come to the United States for us, because they felt that it wasn't just the right thing to do politically, but, you know, that's the kind of sacrifices that the parents have to make for their kids, and in order to give us something that we didn't have. And I think, like, you know, all these, you know, a lot of our thinking, a lot of, you know, what means so much to us comes from this Roman Catholic background, or just really this Christian background that we're all grounded in.
Thank you very much for that answer. And yes, the Roman Catholic tradition, of course, is very expansive and in its theology and spirituality as well mm-hmm. as, for example, the life of the saints. Which is a lot of my background as a mm-hmm. scholar and author on the Catholic mystical tradition. So mm-hmm. why were you drawn to the Sufi path, for example, as opposed to looking to the mystical tradition in the Catholic tradition?
Well, one of the things I found was, you know, the the reading the stories of the saints played a big, big role in my life, and it sort of helped to seed this, or give a voice really to this longing I've had. And for years I searched and searched and searched, and I think, like many of the Sufis have said, you know, you don't find Sufism, Sufism finds you, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like, you know, you search, you read books, and then after a while, you just, I feel you come to this point of almost like a despair, because you're trying to live something you can't understand and use that to move forward or to advance in your life, inwardly as well as outwardly. So I can't say for certain what it was that drew me to Sufism, but I do know that I read something somewhere about when I was in sophomore year of college, and it just made me say, wow, and made me take a pause. And then I kept reading more, and then about 8 years later, I ended up being initiated as a Darvish, and you know, the story goes from there. But I think always there's a call, and our call takes us to where we're supposed to be, as opposed to we make a lot of effort, and you know, our effort brings us to where we have to be. I think in the mystical realm, it's always a bringing. You're brought to a place as opposed to, you know, going to a place. It's your job to be, to listen and be attentive, but you're always in the end brought to a place.
Well, thank you. That's fascinating that, you know, when you were in college, it came to you. I think many people sort of, not write off necessarily, but consider kids in college or young people in general looking to just, you know, cram for a test and then go get the next beer. And here you are at the, you know what I'm saying? I went to NYU.
it was a very strange experience, because from the time I was really young, I had a lot of experiences that I couldn't place, I couldn't understand. And no matter who I would talk to, no one could explain what they meant. And just moments, sometimes of great solitude, within that solitude, something that I guess the closest word you can come to would be a love, a feeling of union with something. And they're very traumatic experiences, because they happened when I was really young. I even remember watching cartoons sometimes, some Sunday morning. This was in elementary school, and I'd be daydreaming and just taken to a place or just through an experience. So I think that kind of kept me from doing it. Not kept me, but I can never really, after those experiences, get involved so much in, you know, what's typical, what a lot of people imagine to be typical of a lot of young people and
right.
Our behavior and such.
Right, and here you are with a total, you know, thirst for the spiritual quest in college, and winds up being the sort of centerpiece for your life
exactly.
And work as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned becoming a dervish.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little more about that.
Sure.
And because it's wonderful that there you are looking for a mystical tradition, and then at some point you sort of gave up.
And
it came to you in a different set of words, and perhaps from a different tradition, and made that connection for you. So now, tell us about your experience of, as you said, being initiated as a Darvish. And what is a Darvish? What does he do?
Okay, so the best way I could explain is that when someone is brought to the Sufi path, I would make the analogy of almost someone going to be entering a course of study. And the end goal is to be a Sufi, a person who has sort of died to what he thinks, or he or she thinks himself to be, and lives the reality of what we really are. And that's the end goal of, you know, walking the Sufi path. And a Darvish is someone who is going through the courses of it. And so the goal of a Darvish, you know, which I think many people find difficult, is just to live, is to be a good husband, be a good brother, and, you know, so obviously I'm a brother to my younger sister, to just be an all-around good person. That's the prerequisite first. You know, like spiritual life, mystical life, all that stuff, I don't have a word for it, but all that starts after the point that we can be a good human being, really. And it's not like, you know, you can pick up a book and, you know, there has to be a sense of balance in your life. Because if I'm reading Rumi and Ibn Arabi and all these great people, but I'm not a good spouse to the person who lives with me, then I'm kind of a hypocrite. So the first part of this is to live really what it means to be a human being, you know. So and to me, that is just, you know, being or having a lot of my actions come from a point of love and respect for my fellow human being. So that's part of, you know, that's a major, major part, if not one of the more important parts, because it's very easy in reading a lot of spiritual books to sort of not have your feet planted firmly in the day-to-day. And Sufism, and I think all mystical practice, you have to, as much as you're in an inner place, you know, living this experience, you have to live outwardly, you know, these other experiences with your friends, your family, you know, people on the train who annoy you, everyone.
Yeah,
you know, can't draw a line between that. So.
Now, do you find that the path, this particular mystical path, has given you a practice that you were not able to find as a Christian or Catholic, something specific?
Well, when I used to go to church and I used to oftentimes ask a lot of questions, and I was always told, you know, you just have to believe. And I never...
Wow.
Yeah, it's like you just happen to believe in all this. And I said to myself, like, you know, you read, you know, there's this beautiful ritual where you're, you know, you take the Eucharist, you get the body and the blood of Christ, but behind all the nice words, what does that mean? Like, what does that really mean? And so no matter where I went, I was just told to believe. And I think the Sufi path, or what I, it feels a little difficult in talking about it to call it a Sufi path, because I feel all paths, you know, they lead to the same goal. And underneath, you know, the social or cultural differences, it's the same beautiful story being unfolded. But to get back to your question, you know, this practice of remembrance that Sufis do, where, you know, in everything we do, with every breath, we try to remember God, or try to live our connection. So, for instance, if I'm cooking dinner for my wife, in my kitchen, I have this line by Rumi, which you know, to me always brings to mind that this physical hunger I feel, in many ways, is a mask to another hunger, and that's a primal hunger, and that I'm doing a service for the people I'm cooking the food for. So, or if I'm at work, if I'm at work and I have a task to do, you know, that this task is, you know, I work in the field of science, and you know, part of the work I do is, you know, we work on influenza, for instance, the influenza disease, and so this work that I'm doing, you know, although I'm being paid, you know, that's just the minimum. There's a service I have to provide. And, you know, with everything I do, even this most simplest act of breathing is a gift. And I have to make sure that this gift is used to the utmost. And that, to me, is one way of approaching this practice of remembering God, or what Sufis call zek, or remembering.
Thank you. That's very, very good answer. It's interesting what you said before about asking a question, you know, to, like, what does the Eucharist mean, you know?
Yes.
You know, I guess it depends who you ask, because, you know, St. Augustine would have said it means you are what you eat. Mm-hmm. And that would be sacrifice, as you said before about your parents, sacrifice and service to others, as what you just said now about your work, and which you're also finding in your own, in your practice as a Sufi. But now, what are the forms of practice? Because a lot of people hear the word dervish and think of the whirling dervish, the dancing, the chanting. Is that the only form of practice?
Well, no. In the history of Sufism, there was a point where various paths arose. And so, for instance, you have the Naqshbandi Sufis, which they focus a lot on a silent zek. They're called the silent zek, Sufis. You have also the Mevlevi who do this dance. You have so many different types, actually, and each type sort of harps on one particular way. And so the way I look at it is that, you know, to go on this journey, each soul has its own requirement. Some souls, for instance, will gravitate more towards experiencing God through silence. Some souls through the experience of music. Some soul, you know, through whatever other techniques are offered by these various other paths within Sufism. But I think one Sufi, I can't remember right now, put it best that each different branch is, well, each different path of Sufism, they're like different branches on a tree of loving kindness. It's like we each approach a certain way according to our own inner dictates, our own inner propensities. So what may seem to be, you know, like these dervishes dance, you know, in the sama, these other dervishes are silent, these other dervishes say a vocal zek, you know, or something like that. You know, ultimately, it's this journey, you know, through the vehicle of sincerity and loving kindness to the goal. You know, if we're more than just branches, it implies a competition, but it's just one tree of loving kindness.
Thank you. Now, have you experienced any resistance from friends or family members when you went through this change as a Catholic?
I feel like I'm a very shy person, and I never really talk about these kind of things. So it was always quiet, you know, except amongst my immediate family and friends. And for them, you know, they've always known that I've had this search. So they're open to it. But however, you know, for some other people, like even on the blog, every now and then I get strange mail. Last year, I remember during the time when there was this debate about building the mosque near Ground Zero, I got a lot of weird comments, you know. And I say weird, but I don't know the politically correct term for it. But, yeah. You know, it's just that I get a lot of those things, you know, because I feel drawn to talk about my ideas on the blog in that format. So in some cases I get, you know, weird comments like that. Other times, I guess from people who don't know me so well, you know, I feel like one of the most radical things you can say to someone nowadays is that you believe in God. You know, it's one of those really polarizing sort of statements. And so just that alone, and then, you know, somehow it comes out that you're a mystic or a dervish, and you know, all these images from Hollywood or the news or anything comes along, and, you know, before you know it, you know, certain people just, you know, keep their distance because they don't know how to place you. They don't know what that means.
Well, that's very, very interesting what you're saying right now, because we find, of course, that whenever we step on the path a little bit, you know, outside those boxes, of course, there's reaction, because moving forward together in a peaceful manner may not be so easy to just put people in boxes anymore. Yeah. And you're exploring your path, and, you know, with the modern technology of computers, the internet, and the blogs, of course, makes your experience known to many more people. At the same time, you know, so much of the purpose of this program and the Institute is to inform and to educate, because of those reactions, those knee-jerk reactions of from folks who might just be scared and who just, you know, don't know their neighbor perhaps that well.
I think that's, you know, no, and when I think about these kind of situations, especially in New York, I look back historically, and I feel like, you know, the whole age of reason has sort of given way to the age of polemics, where anything you say sort of catalyzes you as this particular type of thing. I think, you know, being so materialistic and focusing on, you know, what's exterior, we've gotten very good at classifying and organizing, but we can reduce things down to their essence, but we can never put them back together into something living. So we can say this person's a liberal, is a conservative, they like this, they like that, but ultimately we're left bereft because we know nothing about that person, because the external labels are just labels. They have nothing to do with the reality of what it is to be alive, the reality of what it is to live, to suffer, to die, to grow old. You know, we never approach any of those things. So once we find something challenging, the challenge is this neat little simulacra of a life that we've created for ourselves. You know, we have this huge emotional reaction towards it.
Well said. Yes. Yes. Now, we're going to get more into, for example, 9/11 and blogging and such in the second part of the show. But before we do that, I just would like to ask you, because I know that getting into the Quran was mm-hmm. very formative for you and impressed you in a, you know, kind of permanent way. And mm-hmm. as you've said, helps you to have a greater reverence for your faith, for the Catholic faith.
Yeah,
can we get a little into that? Because that's, of course, where the rubber starts meeting road.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In about January 2009, I had been initiated as a dervish for a few months then, and I was just reading, I think, part of the Masnavi of Rumi, and I said, how strange that, you know, all these great Sufis that I am reading, you know, they were, you know, practicing Muslims. And, you know, like, with Rumi being such a wide-selling poet in America, I think we often miss that part that his name was, you know, Rumi was his pen name. His first primary name was Muhammad, you know. So especially in light of, like, for instance, Bill Maher's comment that, you know, the rise of the name Muhammad in England was something to be feared of or something to be scared of. So I just find that there's some sort of contention there. And so I said to myself, let me look at the Quran. Let me just see what it's about. Because first, so much of my own tradition is based on, you know, the acts of, you know, the Prophet and his companions and the revelations of the Quran. So I said to myself, you know, I have nothing to lose, only to gain. So let me just dive in. And I bought a copy at Barnes & Noble's on 86th Street, and I started reading. And it was just, I think what my approach to it was, let me leave everything I heard about it behind, and let me not look at the words, but the experiences from which the words come from. I think that's something we don't do a lot when we read, because, you know, the greatest stories we hear come from a living experience. And so I said, I want that living essence, you know, because, like, if you look at making bread, you know, you can add the water, the salt, but without the yeast, it'll, without something living, without that living element, it'll never become bread or something that can nourish or sustain you.
That's right.
So that was the approach I took to that, and I just found it to be phenomenal. I found it to be, when I went just beyond the surface of just what I thought Islam was, what I thought a Muslim person followed, when I tried to get to the experience, I found, just with different terminology, a lot of the same realizations that, you know, I found when I read through the Bible. You know, just this, that, you know, it's easy to say that there's one God, but what does the experience of that mean? And I, you know, with Jesus, this experience, you know, he administered to everyone, you know,
right,
regardless of religion and anything.
Dave? I'm not sure where Dave, I think he lost the call. Dave, hopefully he'll call back in very quickly. In the meantime, I do know that when people, yes, he's getting back on the line right now. We're going to just wait a moment because I do want to ask him about the Quran. And hello, Dave? Are you back? Hey, Dave?
Yeah.
So as we were saying, I wanted to ask you about the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised to find Jesus and Moses in there?
Actually, yes, I was, actually. I went to Catholic school and elementary school and high school, and we never really talked about other religions or other faiths. And I think that nothing makes your faith richer than by experience or by reading and learning about what other people do. Really, because I was surprised to see a chapter in there about Mary, mother of Jesus, about Jesus being a prophet. And, you know, and I feel like if a lot of people have know that, that it'll be a different, such a different sort of situation. And if a lot of people know that a lot of things that they don't like about Islam are really, like, for instance, the practice of female circumcision is really doesn't have its origins in Islam, but in some of the societies where Islam grew from. I think that would be, that would really change our idea of the supposed enemy that, that we have that a lot of times the media paints in Muslims. So I really feel that education is extremely, extremely important, because without it, it, we naturally would tend to see people as other and our and ourselves and, you know, people close to us as a special group. And I think education is necessary to break down that barrier.
Did you find as a Catholic or someone of Catholic background that when you came across Jesus and Mary and Moses in the Quran that there was some sort of a that perhaps Islam were some kind of family or cousins or brothers that you didn't realize you had?
Yeah, yeah. It's
like the story went beyond your own family.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a revelation that if everyone had, the world would be a different place, really. Because I kind of see, you know, Ibn Arabi talks about this, how all prophets are there, whatever religion, you know, all these prophets are there to offer you an example to follow. And, you know, St. Teresa of Avila, she wrote this beautiful poem where she said that every prophet's name is a key that will unlock, you know, the presence of God to you. And so if someone says there is no God but God and Jesus is his messenger, there is no God but, and another person says there is no God but Muhammad and Muhammad is his messenger, I think we get caught up on the difference in name rather than the first statement, which is that there is nothing but God. You know, there's nothing but this divine experience. You know, and I feel that if we actually look at that statement, you know, or like Jesus' statement, I and my Father are one, you know, there's no, if historically we ever really looked at that statement, we wouldn't have a lot of the conflict that we have now.
Because, thank you so much, Dave.
Sure.
Now we are at the breaking point in the show. We are about halfway through. It goes by quickly.
Yes,
stay on the line.
Sure.
You are going to take a moment to do a station ID. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going to take a short break, but after the break, we will continue our conversation with award-winning Sufi blogger David Pakio. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with Echo, with a favorite from his CD, Future Primitive. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute, live on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're speaking with award-winning Sufi blogger David Pakio. Dave, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Now, that piece of music, I just love that, and I feel if we all sort of listened to that every morning before we left the house, I think, you know, the day might go a little perkier. And you know, when we think of spirituality, isn't that kind of what it's about, which is, you know, when you open your door and go out to meet and interact with the world, it's where it's lived out.
Yeah, yeah, it's, I think it's, you know, living in the world is almost like, you know, like the gladiators, you know, who go out into the Colosseum, you know. I think one thing which is important for me that I think about a lot is that once I leave home, I don't know what happens. I may never, and then never return to my wife and see my pets and, you know, all my stuff. So everything I do is really important because, like, nothing is guaranteed to us. You know, like when I heard about the earthquake in Haiti or just tragic events like the tsunami in Japan, you know, this idea that we have of security is just so false, really. Because,
yes, yeah.
No, nothing is promised to us, really.
And in a similar way, perhaps, you know, back in 01 when, as a New Yorker myself back then, you know, many opened up their doors and walked out on a Tuesday morning expecting to have their regular day.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Walked into an event that, of course, was a complete cataclysm for us as New Yorkers, something that touched really at the soul, if you will, of the city, and, you know, difficult to talk about to this day.
Yeah, very. I remember I was on the train to my 9 o'clock. I was getting to school early to study, either for some homework or some test, and I was taking the 2 train, and then, you know, everything stopped, and then, you know, eventually the access to get out of the station, and I was near in Crown Heights, I believe. I don't remember where what stopped. And then I saw smoke coming from the Twin Towers. And then I was just like, wow, this is... I didn't really know how to take it because, it, you know, having the Twin Towers there was such an enduring part of your identity as a New Yorker, you know?
Yeah. And then it was the view from my apartment when I used to live in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And... yes, and it's, you know, that New York City, I mean, went through a tremendous, if you want to talk about a spiritual transformation, that day, what you referred to as Ground Zero, is certainly a catalyst for spiritual change. And I don't know what you saw personally, you know, through that experience, but we do know about how people just naturally reached out for each other, even in these dire circumstances, in that time to help each other. What are your thoughts on how that affected your path then going forward?
Well, it's unfortunate though, but I oftentimes think that even looking at my own life, it always takes sometimes a cataclysm to awaken us to what we're really here for. And I looking back on that, it just really it was like one of those events that just told me that nothing is promised. You know, that if you have a longing for something, whether it's spirituality, whatever your longing is, you know, there's a reason why you've been sort of granted such a longing, and how could, you know, it just gave a sense of immediacy to many things. Like, what, you know, how can I, if nothing is promised to me and I feel compelled to do something, how can I justify putting that off? How can I justify sort of going through life and not living really to the fullest extent? And so that was like a real wake-up call, and seeing people together just really, it really changed in many ways, you know, those few days, my opinion of people. Because, you know, we depict New York as kind of a very fast, unfriendly pace, and I feel if people in New York could come together, despite all our, you know, so many different cultures and so many different languages spoken here, you know, if we, despite all those differences, can come together, I mean, there's more than hope for the future. It's the only thing that really, another thing that really was impressed upon me is just that I hope it doesn't take more and more calamity to get us to do something which is so natural, you know?
Yeah, I understand that.
It's like how many tsunamis in Japan or earthquakes in Haiti will it take just for us to treat each other with the respect that we deserve, just not for the religion we follow, just for the fact that we're born, you know, because that's
right.
An amazing miracle.
Yes, as one human family.
Yeah, exactly.
To behave in that manner.
I think before we say that this person is a Muslim or this person is a Christian, we should stop and say that, or a Jew or a Hindu, we should stop and say this is a person.
Right, and you're right. When we experience some kind of crisis, that's when that comes out, and that's who we actually are. It's almost like being awakened somehow from our you know, workaday dream of, you know, we're commuting, we go to the office, we commute, we go home. You know, leave me alone.
You know, Rumi says that our wounds are where the light comes in. So if I think that's really important because 9/11 was a big wound. And our collective psyche individually. But however, if we look at that consciously, that's where the light comes in. Because in those moments, I mean, look at our natural reaction. Our natural reaction wasn't to annoy or pester or bother people, but open up our hearts to them.
Yes. Yes, and in a city that big with that much diversity, the instinct was not to blame or turn to each other in any hostility.
Yeah, exactly. So,
go ahead.
No, I was saying that it's, a few days later, there are some isolated events where, not everyone was treating everyone with the respect they deserve. But that was no way by far, the majority. That was just like a few cases. So, that really just confirmed that to me.
Now let's talk more about your work as a writer and blogger online, because that of course is a whole new chapter in communication for people of faith around the world. What drew you to becoming a blogger and eventually an award-winning one at that?
Actually, two things. One is that, I guess during that time I was going through so much tumultuous change that I felt the need to talk, and I would talk to my wife a lot, and at some point she says, I'm tired. maybe you can find some other people to talk with, I mean, and so I was like, well, it is pretty late, and, we do have to wake up early, and so I said I felt this need to express something. And then I saw online that, a lot of people were talking, and I said, through blogs, and I said that I never felt myself to be anyone special. I always felt I was a regular, basic person, and a lot of times when we come to any spiritual tradition, whether we read about Buddha or, these great Hindus of the past or the saints, we hear about them in light of, the luminosity of what they've done with themselves. It's like very rarely do you hear about the person who is late on bills, has stuff to do, and is trying to live just the spiritual calling. So I said that maybe I'd find someone to talk to if I just put all the stuff I was experiencing out there. And
right.
So between all of that, that's how the blog happened. And I'm just so surprised. I'm still surprised to this day that people read it, because it's just me putting stuff out there. There's no, it's beautiful that some people read and give me comments, and I've had the opportunity to talk to many people in the world, but it was just this need to express myself, really.
And you have different components there. There are articles, there's books, I believe, book reviews. It's a sort of a broad scope of things.
Yeah. I have, anybody who has something interesting to say, I mean, obviously that doesn't in any way disrespect others, I'm more than happy to put that there. People recommend me books, and I read it, and I review it there. Other articles that I've read, on Sufism, on Buddhism, and anything that sparks something in me, I share it with everyone because, you know, I think it's only right, you know, I feel, you know, something comes across to me and it makes me think about things differently. I should, it's part of my duty to share that with anybody else who happens to find themselves here. It's almost like a meal. You know, if I'm cooking dinner and my sister says I'm hungry or someone I know needs something, you know, it's my duty to open the door or to put an extra chair at the table, and I feel it extends the same way to blogging, really.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds very hospitable. What do you think about the blogosphere and how it might be helping to affect awareness and change in general? Because there are so many people doing blogs on religion and young people and who go viral with their exposure. What are your thoughts on this as just a phenomenon and how it affects things?
I felt like, my great-grandmother, before she died, she told me this. She died at 96. She was born in 1905, I think. She told me about the first time, she was a peasant. She used to work the field in Haiti, and she said the first time they saw an airplane in the sky, they ran for cover because they didn't know what it was. They thought it was some sort of weird apparition or something. Mm. Now, you know, there's an amazing role that technology plays, you know. We can no longer say that we're really isolated from each other. You know, whereas before we used to have like a mountain or a sea or a continent would separate one person from another, that separation doesn't exist anymore. And I think we really move towards a global culture. And so I think everybody, it gave everybody a greater chance for a voice. So, like, in the revolutions that we saw in Northern Africa and Egypt and stuff, and blogging played a huge role. And this is one of the things I always feel that, you know, in the history of humanity, you know, there's a time when I guess we have a change in our consciousness. And I noticed that when that happens, the means of how we communicate changes. I mean, another point in history was the printing press. It just made knowledge accessible.
Right.
There's so many people and forever change what we consider to be the barriers of society then, and I feel the internet is doing the same thing now, and in the sense that if I wanted to learn something, I could just as easily go online and search as I could go to a library and such. So I think the internet has the possibility to really bring people together, and not just through, for instance, what the media puts up, but living stories. I can read about someone in Egypt and what they're actually living, as opposed to hearing secondary reporting of what is going on and what someone's interpretation is. And I think, it's like that living element, like the yeast that we put to make the bread. Then the story becomes not just mere fact, but something that can nourish us.
Yes, and then you become the authority of your own story, and it doesn't have to go through another filter.
It's a
fascinating time that we're living in, because on the one hand it appears that there is so much tumultuous activity in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be an increase in religious intolerance and even violence, and at the same time people like us right now are reaching out toward each other using this amazing technology that lets us connect in ways we've never been able to before around the world at the same time to reach toward each other in mm-hmm. in healing, not in fragmentation.
I always feel that I see that in many, you know, like there has to be labor pains for the baby to be born, and Rumi says, if the clouds never cried, how could anything grow, you know? So, you know, it's, you know, like Confucius says, a happy man thinks happy thoughts. If in this tumultuous time we see it not as, if we see it as an opportunity, really, while we can really, I feel, make one step in sincerity and really move forward.
Mm. Thank you so much. Yes, and I love what you said before that Rumi said, our wounds are where our life comes in.
Yeah, the wounds are where the light comes in.
Yes, and also about the clouds, we need the rain for our new growth.
It's a beautiful passage. He said that he starts by saying, if the baby never cried, how could the mother know to feed it? And he said the same way. the clouds have to cry for there to be rain. And he's like, you have to cry in a way so the friend can come to you, you know, so God can come to you. So that act of crying, if we see it as just a lament as opposed to breaking out into something new and something that can sustain us, I think that's the challenge now, to really be aware and not let how we used to see things for the last couple of centuries really dictate how we step and the directions we take in this new sort of era.
Now, Dave, do you perceive conflicts between faiths at their spiritual core, at their essence?
No, actually, I feel the conflict lies only on the surface level. Because if one hasn't, you know, like, for instance, if I say I'm born a Christian because my parents were Christians, I'm not really a Christian, I feel. I feel that if you look at my life and you see from my actions essence of what Jesus' life represented, then I'm a Christian. You know, the same way that if I'm on the beach and I see and I say this wave is different from another wave, I mean, on the surface of the beach, yeah, there are different waves. If I go out into the ocean, it's one sea. So I feel that part of the reason we have conflict is because we don't go deep enough into the experience of what it means really to follow a religion.
And we're staying on the surface with things like names and labels and boxes, like you were saying before.
Yeah, like if in Christianity we're taught to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, and Islam, there's the teaching to, you know, be charitable, to be hospitable to your neighbor. And, you know, it's like if we're both focused on being charitable and loving each other, where can there be room to sort of treat each other as we have been historically? I think we have to acknowledge that we really, if we're religious in any sense, and if there's a, you know, if we have to acknowledge that in some cases we haven't been really doing our responsibility, because if I'm taken up in trying to love one another and trying to support myself and my family and you know, feed the, you know, like the Beatitudes, feed the poor, you know, visit those who are sick, if I'm really doing that and living a good life, I have no time or energy to be mean or violent towards someone, really, I feel.
Thank you, Dave. Now, where do you see your path leading you down the line? What's next along this path? Years from now, what do you see?
Well, I so much of the Sufi path is from what I've experienced it, is to get you to live in the moment. There's this eternal moment from which everything comes from. You know, in every second, you know, nothing is the same. Everything is new. And so it's hard to sort of think in terms of time going forward when you're always trying to center yourself in the eternal presence that is manifest in that moment. I have a lot of goals for myself externally. Like, you know, I'd like to, you know, go on a nice vacation and all that other stuff. Maybe go back for my PhD or do all those kinds of things. But internally, I can say right now, I want to be at a place where I don't want anything, if that makes sense.
Well, yes. It does.
You know, like, I feel like so much of my time in the past, like, well, I want this, I want that, and then, like, you know, you go through some calamity and you realize I never needed that, and so I'm starting to see and feel that in every moment I'm given exactly what I need. So almost sometimes it feels, what is there to want, really? And so if I can reach that sort of place, you know, God willingly, then I feel that, you know, that would be somewhat sort of a great accomplishment, at least.
Thank you, Dave. Now, in your study or in your practice, are there any other particular texts or resources that you utilize that you might be able to recommend to people?
You know, for each person, it's different. I know some dervishes who, you know, spend their time focused on just meditation and stuff. Others who like to read, but it's for each person is different. For myself, I sort of have this real, I'm a real bibliophile, and I just love reading anything and everything. So I spent a lot of time, reading the works of Sufis of, I can call them antiquity, you know, from the historic sense, like
right.
Rumi, Ibn Arabi, Ghazali, so on and so forth. But I've also, for instance, find much value in the works of someone like Paramahansa Yogananda, from someone from all traditions, really. So it's hard for me to think of a particular set, you know. For instance, I can give you like one work which moved me a lot was the Garden of Mystery by Shabistari. It was very beautiful. But however, you know, like other Darvishes that I know, like some people find it too obtuse, some plain language. But, you know, I feel like as Shabistari says, he says this line that every Sufi is a rare flower in this garden of mystery. So it's hard to sort of, you know, after reading that and experiencing how unique we each are to really put forth like a list of texts.
You mentioned Rumi before. Is there a particular
yes.
Collection you might like to recommend?
There's one collection which was done by a professor in Rutgers. His name is Jawed. I'm trying to remember his last name. I see it, but I can't pronounce it. And he did a really great translation of Rumi. I find that I've liked a lot of Coleman Barks' translation of the works.
Oh, yes.
Although some people really don't like that at all. I feel the majority of... I have many different translations of Rumi in my own reading. And the same for instance, like Ibn Arabi. I know William Chittick has done some really great stuff. And then there's Henry Corbin. And But if there's a work I've sat with the most over the years, it's been the works of my own, I guess, Sufi Sheikh, Dr. Javad Nirbash, and that of Rumi and his Masnavi.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Sure.
Now, what kind of advice would you have for today's youth who are struggling with their own journey or seeking and not necessarily finding out there? Do you have any words of inspiration or guidance for young people today?
Well, what comes to mind is this quote that says that the footprints go just up to the sea and then are seen no more. Basically, you have to go. I mean, it sounds like something out of sports, but you have to let it all hang loose to go for what it is that you want. You know, I think there's nothing wrong with ambition, as long as we realize, you know, the end of it. You know, that there's that beautiful line in Caesar where you talk about how ambition can be of ruin,
yeah.
But I don't think that's necessarily the case, you know. So I think that for the youth of today, you have to dream big because so much is new right now. So much is it's almost like the world is new again, and so much to be explored. And you need, I feel that you just need that attitude of a sense of wonder, really. I think any longing you have with a sense of wonder does amazing things. And if I can, I have a quote of Rumi that I keep in my room that I look at. If I can read it for you, I think that...
Oh, sure.
Rumi says, different degrees of domination and servitude are what you know as love. But love is different. It arrives complete, just there, like the moon at the window. Seek only that which you have no clue. Desire only that of which you have no hope. This is not the Oxus River or some little creek. This is the shoreless sea. Here, swimming ends always in drowning. That's a quote I have. And I think that dreaming big, that to reach for something which everyone tells you can't reach, to seek for something that you have no clue how to get. I think if we live those sort of that sort of yearning and that sort of wonderment, that you know the world will open up to you. I've never seen the world to be a negative place, and you know, being son of immigrants, not having much of anything, you know, when growing up or having to struggle a lot. I've always seen that. Every time I step in sincerity and I'm willing to put the work, something opens for me. So why not reach for something which everyone tells you can't attain? And that's just how how I've lived and how I've seen things.
Thank you so much, Dave. Now, before we close, could you just remind us of the name of your blog and where people can find you online?
Sure. It's called My Caravan of Dreams. The web address is http caravanofdreams.wordpress.com. And
terrific.
It's just spelled regularly.
Well, thank you so much. We've come to the end of the program, but it's been delightful speaking with you today. So I want to thank you, and perhaps we can touch base again in the future when you have more articles or perhaps a book coming out later.
Sure. I'm working between on the subway, and every moment I get, I'm trying to work on finishing a manuscript. So hopefully soon we can meet again.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This show was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City, engineered by Barry Dwyer and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous shows again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. where you can find my books on the spiritual core of relationships, as well as a library of others. Please send your comments to contact@GodspeedInstitute.com. We love to hear from you. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed always on your journey.